Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, always with Michael McKee. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
The book is called The Euro: How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe. And Joe Stiglitz, everybody knows Joe from Columbia University, winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics. It is his latest work. You're starting to do publicity for this. The reviews are out. And I think a lot of people get the concept of the book wrong. You don't say junk the euro. You say the euro can and should be saved, but it has fundamental design flaws that need to be addressed.
You got it. Yeah, you got it.
All right, I passed your class here.
And I am a little surprised that some of the reviewers didn't get it. I say if you can't fix it, muddling through, which is what they've been doing the minimum required as each crisis comes on, is going to be an extraordinary costly strategy. It's already cost Europe stagnation since 2008. Even the best performing country, Germany, is not doing particularly well. And what I try to argue is that actually it is possible, if they aren't going to do what they need, to move to a system that I call a flexible euro system and an amicable divorce with two, three different currency areas. And that transition could be done in a relatively smooth way. And the benefits of that would be enormous relative to the current system. The fundamental idea is a fixed currency system takes away two of the most important adjustment mechanisms, exchange rates and interest rates.
Right.
They didn't put anything in their place. Instead of putting something in their place, they tied their hands further with constraints on the size of the deficits countries could
The convergence criteria,
which you note are
important, but they were not sufficient.
They were not the things that would make the euro work. And in a recession, they make sure that it doesn't work. And then they said, you know, we've been having all this discussion about the Fed policy. Their European Central Bank has a single mandate, inflation. So they're not supposed to pay any attention to unemployment growth once they solve the focus is inflation. That means they even raised interest rates in 2011 as Europe was going into a recession.
Well, you make the point in here that the European politicians are very proud of their ability to muddle through. They see it as a positive that they can come up with a compromise. And you argue in the book that kicks the can down the road and keeps the system going. But what people aren't focused on is the enormous cost in both treasure and to human beings of muddling along.
Exactly. And that cost you can see in the economies in Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, even Italy and France. The fact is that the worst afflicted countries are in a depression greater than the Great Depression in the United States. So that's a big event. The other countries are basically in a recession. The one, you might say, successful country, Germany, is its growth would be given a D, except for the fact that when you grade on a curve, it looks relatively good.
Compared to the rest.
A third of the people in the population aren't doing very well.
Germany gets a lot of the blame by a lot of observers for what's going on, and you're not alone in suggesting that the Germans have overdone it in terms of trying to make the euro a reflection of Germany. Wolfgang Streeck of the Max Planck Institute argues that Germany's come to consider the European Union an extension of itself.
That's right. And that wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the fact that German views about economics differs from that of the rest of the world. I saw that very clearly. I was chairman of the OECD Economic Policy Committee when I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton. And they had a single-minded focus on inflation. Now, they gave an argument. They said, we went through this experience of inflation that led to Hitler and all. But they'd forgotten their history. It was the high unemployment of the Great Depression that led to Hitler, and they should be worrying about unemployment as giving rise to people, things like the far right, the Golden Dawn in Greece, and the movements and the rightist movements in France.
Joe Stiglitz with us in support of the euro, how a common currency threatens the future of Europe. Mike, continue with Professor Stiglitz. I like this idea of the tension of Germany and the rest of Europe.
Well, you argue for a commitment to shared prosperity in the book, but that has to work in a symmetric manner. Germany argues this is not a transfer union. We're not going to help the rest of the European Union. Can a common currency work under those circumstances?
No. And one of the things they realized at the very beginning is that they had to foster a greater similarity among the countries. But then they made a mistake. They created a set of rules that actually led to divergence. The rich countries got richer. The poor countries got poorer. Germany did very well. The crisis countries did very badly. And it led to what might be called a creditor-debtor relationship. You know, no difference in economic terms is greater than that between a creditor and a debtor. Creditors like high interest rates, debtor likes low interest rates. And what you wound up with was one big creditor, Germany, and lots of debtors. And that kind of a system is inevitably going to have very different perspectives. So you began with very different views about how economies work, what is good economics. Right. And then you compound that with very deep differences in their economic positions.
Joe, many other people are on the same page as you. I think it's important to state that when Martin Feldstein of a school up on a river in Boston and Joe Stiglitz of Columbia are on the same page, that has to get your attention. Where do you and Martin Feldstein have common ground on a more independent Germany with their own Deutsche Mark or some form of new euro?
Well, we both agree very strongly, I think, that the euro, the single currency for this diverse countries, hasn't worked, can't work unless there are a lot more institutions, and I try to describe those. Economically, they could do it. It's not an enormous amount, but politically, it seems a bigger stretch than they are capable of doing now. And then the question is, what is the best way of designing what might be called an amicable divorce? There's widespread view that it would be easier if Germany left, or at least you create a system of what I call flexible euro. The reason it's easier if Germany left is very simple. When the debts are denominated in euros, if Germany leaves, the currency of the remaining countries will go down in value, their exports will go up, their incomes will go up, and they can service those debts much more easily. Germany, meanwhile, its Deutsche Mark will go up, its current account surpluses, which have been a major problem for the global economy, will diminish. And because their currency has gone up, it'll be easier to pay back what it owes. On the other hand, if you have the poorer countries leave, their currency will go down. It will be equivalent to an increase in their leverage because their debt is denominated in euro. And that will weaken those countries and make it more difficult for them to repay their debt. The consequence of that is that it will be inevitable that there will be a rash of bankruptcies. And this is what happened in the case of Argentina. That will have to be managed in the second. And one way of doing it is to denominate the debt and have a new bankruptcy law.
You argue, speaking of the financial aspects of this, is you argue for debt restructuring, particularly in the case of Greece, but you don't say how that would happen. You raise, but you don't refute the possibility that the markets would punish the countries who restructure. So how do you sell restructuring? So far, it hasn't been a really popular idea.
Well, it already happened once, and I think there's a general recognition that if they had restructured the debt in 2010 rather than kicking the can down the road, things would be much better today. You know, Germany talks about the huge amount of money that they've lent to Greece, or that the Europe has lent to Greece. Most of that money went right out of Greece back to German and French banks. And so only about 10% stayed in Greece. It wasn't a bailout to Greece. It was a bailout to the German and French banks who had lent to Greece. They then had to have one debt restructuring. The IMF says that under its rules, it can't lend any more to Greece unless there's another debt restructuring. You know, debt restructurings have been a part of capitalism since the beginning. In the United States, we have a bankruptcy law. Yeah. That's nothing more than a debt restructuring. And the problem is that we haven't developed a smooth way of doing sovereign debt restructuring. The UN reached a consensus on a set of principles guiding sovereign debt restructurings. Unfortunately, the United States opposed that set of principles. But it can be done and has been done repeatedly.
All right, we got just a minute left. Martin Sandbu in Europe's Orphan, in the book Europe Orphan, Adair Turner in his new book, both kind of push back against your diagnosis, saying it's not a failure by design, but it's a failure of policies, including austerity. So if you change the policies, are you optimistic about the euro's future?
No. You know, one of the main points of my book is that the euro was flawed at birth. Of course, you could change the institutions, the rules that guide it. You know, the things like the convergence criteria, rules about the deficit, rules about what the central bank has to focus just on inflation, the absence of a solidarity fund to help those countries that are having problems, the absence of a banking union, absence of common deposit insurance. You could change all that. And as I say, if you did all that, the euro would work. But that's not a question of policy. That's a question of structure. And that's where I think they are fundamentally wrong. What they miss is the following point. You took away the exchange rate as an adjustment mechanism.
Right.
You can change GDP up and down by austerity, but that doesn't change the exchange rate.
Joe, we got to leave it there. Joe Stiglitz, thank you so much. In support of the euro, must read in Europe and America. This is Bloomberg. One of our most popular guests, Greg Valliere, with a scathing note yesterday on likelihood of the GOP losing the House. For those of you worldwide, there's the Senate, there's the House. The Senate's up for grabs. The House back to 1928, I believe, is Republican, Republican, Republican. And even a guy like Valliere is thinking about this.
1994, but
you know. Okay, whatever, 1928. I'm off by 60 years. What do you want? I read three articles yesterday on the new leadership team of Mr. Trump. He's fired the other guys. Well, he didn't fire them. They're like honorary chair. And he's brought in a new team. Greg Valliere on the new Trump. Greg, this team clearly has a resonance with the already voting for Trump. Do you see any indication that the Republicans, and particularly Mr. Trump, can get the marginal undecided voter?
Well, that's the key, Tom. And I think the answer is probably no. The woman they've hired to be a really excellent poll taker to also join the campaign, I think, could help a bit with women. But, you know, there's a real problem, and it's not at the top of the campaign. The problem is the infrastructure of the campaign. There's a bunch of amateurs poorly funded in states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Wouldn't it be ironic, with all of this rhetoric about emails and, you know, Hillary Clinton's foundation, if this election really turns on the ground game? And the Republican ground game is terrible.
You combine that with what seems to be an effort to let loose the hounds of Trump on the internet again. And if you are Paul Ryan, if you are running for the Senate, and even some people in the House, you got to be terrified.
Yeah, you're right, Mike. And I think this may be the last straw for Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and John McCain and other Republicans who see in this new campaign director somebody who has savagely attacked people like Paul Ryan in personal terms. He supported Ryan's primary opponent. So there's a lot of bad blood, and this is almost a repudiation of the Republican establishment in Washington.
I want to ask you a question. This is not directly to Donald Trump right now, but this came up yesterday in a conversation I was having with a very senior Republican. At what point does Paul Ryan say enough, and could he be better off for his long-term political career by rejecting Donald Trump now?
Well, first of all, I think he's close to that point. I think he's very, very close to that point. This guy, Stephen Bannon, has been a really vicious critic of Ryan. But would he be better off? I don't know. I think the base in the Republican Party, the very activist Tea Party, talk radio base, maybe 35% of the party, I think would forever reject Ryan, as they will forever reject Ted Cruz if Ryan turns against Trump.
Well, I guess then your question is, what Republican Party is left? The old Groucho Marx line about, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me. Would Ryan want to be in charge of the Trump Republican Party, or would he be better off trying to, you know, reform the party from the outside?
Well, already, and isn't this ironic, guys, already we're talking about post-election. Who do you blame? The recriminations are going to come hot and heavy in November after Trump loses. And I think that a lot of people would like to see Ryan, you know, rise from the ashes of the defeat. But I'm not sure Ryan has the base of the party behind him.
Well, I got like eight ways to go. We could talk to Greg Villiers for 3 hours today and not run out of things to talk about. Did I hear you say, Mr. Villiers, that you would suggest Speaker Ryan will act or slash make a decision soon?
I think he's got to think really strongly about whether he could support someone who has a campaign director, this guy Bannon, who has been scathing on personal terms toward Ryan. I think this may be the last straw. And I got to tell you guys, you talk to Republicans in this town, and they are all rooting for Trump to lose.
Okay, you know, Greg, help me here with your research note the other day, where we all understand the Senate's in play, and even Mr. Portman of Ohio seems challenged, et cetera. Help me with the House. I saw, you know, the way I read your world, one article said, absolutely out of your mind, and they'll never lose it. And the other one really walked through the GOP losing the House. Is that feasible?
It's not out of the question. You have to have a 30-seat turnover for the Democrats to regain control. I think they could get 20. I think beyond 20 is going to be a pretty tall order. Unless Hillary Clinton wins in a historic, epic landslide, then all bets are off. But I'm in a range of about 15 to 20, so their power gets diluted, and I do think the Senate flips back to the Democrats.
Do you have this as a Goldwater-like election right now? Nate Silver, it's stunning what he's got in electoral votes.
Not quite. I still think there are some variables that have to play out. We've got three debates. The first one is September 26th. You've got this creepy guy, Julian Assange, who's going to release like 30,000 more Hillary emails.
Yeah, Mike McKee's in all those.
So there's still wild cards that make me think that while she's obviously the favorite, she's not the shoo-in.
Something we should address here, because the Washington Post is all over this morning, and you have it in your note. Mr. Trump has now decided he's going to raise health questions about Hillary Clinton. The Post does a great line-by-line takedown of everything, every rumor about her health, and apparently it's basically everything's a lie, but it's out there.
Four Pinocchios, the Washington Post says. And, you know, this criticism from Trump comes from someone who's addicted to fried food and cheeseburgers and never exercises. So I think he's got to be careful about throwing stones from his glass tower. So I think that in an election this nasty, it will be an issue. She had a severe concussion. She fell, hit her head when she had a bad flu, had blurred vision. But from all indications, she's fine. But Trump and Sean Hannity and others are trying trying to allege that she has a fatigue problem or a balance problem. You know, she's about to turn 69. I mean, she gets tired. She doesn't work every weekend. But for Trump, who's 70 and does not appear to be the picture of great health, that to me is a stretch.
Tom and I get tired. We don't.
Yeah, I was going to say, why you, our producer, Greg, our producer, Y.U. Yen, who's cut and chiseled, is laughing and pointing at me right now.
Hey, what do you think of this theory that's going around, Greg? I know it's going around Washington. It's going around New York. He's got Mr. Bannon from Breitbart. He's got Roger Ailes, the deposed head of Fox News, advising him. And his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, runs a newspaper up here, the New York Observer, that he knows he's going to lose. He just wants to build the brand and then start a media company when this is over.
Well, you hear that a lot. I travel all around the country and talk to investors. For the last two or three months, their main question was, is this the choice we have? There's no other choice. And, you know, I don't think Gary Johnson is going to do that well. But the question I get now all the time is, does he really want to win? Or is there a plan B, that this is the ultimate branding exercise for Trump, Inc., and that he'll land on his feet after the election? You know, there may be some truth to that, but I do think he still feels that solid debates and maybe some new revelations on Hillary could put him in the game in November, that it's not out of the question.
The debates are going to be kind of key now. Is this new group going to help him, or is he just going to, you know, fire away?
Yeah, you know, I'm an old Boston Red Sox fan, and we used to always say, let Manny be Manny, Manny Ramirez. So they're going to let Trump be Trump. I mean, they're going to let him let it rip. And he's going to be incendiary and outrageous and politically incorrect. His base will love it. But how does this get him more votes, as you said earlier in this interview? Does it expand his base? I'm not sure it would.
Greg, thank you so much. Never enough time. Greg Valliere, and of course we'll be speaking to him more and more as we move to the election. It is such a different election, Michael McKee, with everybody's politics.
The most amusing election in a long time.
And, you know, we look at Facebook Live, and of course, thanks to Michael McKee for doing Facebook Live, and of course, all we do out on social. And, you know, I would basically say, Michael Barr, would you say as a general rule, if you mention Mr. Trump, whatever the topic, you get three times the hits or whatever digital phrase you want to use.
Well, yeah, because he makes the news.
He's making the news. The interest is there, and we thank people like Greg Valliere for trying to give us some form of balanced perspective. Mike,
who is completely useless for the next 5 minutes because Ellen Zentner and I are going to talk fishing.
Mike, 120 acres on the Jefferson River in the middle of nowhere in Montana. This has Ellen Zentner's name on it.
Yeah. Well, it's both of our – we're splitting it. It sounds great, doesn't it?
We're going to build a compound there.
For
the Waterloo and Jefferson Rivers. Have you been there?
The Jefferson, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Jefferson, magnificent river for fishing. Catch some big, big trout there, Tom.
The size of your leg. Mike, continue.
You know, maybe the Fed would be better off if we could just take them all out.
Exactly.
And they could relax.
Well, the whole reason why Jackson Hole is Jackson Hole, the Kansas City Fed holds their symposiums there, is because of fly fishing. And you know, when you're fly fishing, You don't have room in your brain to think about anything else but the task at hand, and it's such a great reset. And you'll notice that top CEOs, people with high stress jobs, a lot of chief economists, let's say, we love to fly fish, and there's
certain
a reason for it.
Certain hosts of this program,
certain hosts,
consecutively,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, as Tom likes to say, a segue, because it could take us right into Jackson Hole, since Chairman Volcker won't be there fly fishing, and I don't think Janet Yellen fly fishes, which leaves her with her speech next week. Are you in the camp that thinks that she might actually use it in a Bernanke-like way to send a message?
I really don't. And I don't think there's a message to send. I think what we have been given is a gift that this topic of designing new monetary policy frameworks, which is chosen so well in advance of the symposium, happens to be the most prescient topic of the day and something that policymakers are increasingly focused on, coming to grips with the fact that we could be in a world of or near zero interest rates for a very long time. And so how do you design a new monetary policy regime around that to recognize that? You know, the minutes yesterday, which are 300 pages pared down to anywhere from 13 to 17 pages, the Fed chose to devote half a page of that to the discussion of how to think about new monetary policy frameworks. And that really preps us for what the discussion is going to be like at Jackson Hole. And so I think the important thing for us is to gauge from Janet Yellen, where does she come down in that debate of just how long we could be at the zero lower bound, and what else can be done when you are faced with that situation.
Does she have to come down, or can she say, I don't know yet?
Well, she can easily say, we don't know, and this is something we're exploring. But that in itself is a dovish message.
Yeah,
right?
We're not going to do anything because we don't know what to do.
Because we already know that pretty much every one of her cronies on the Fed is coming to this realization and have talked about real equilibrium rates being very low and may not rise.
Let me move away from this ethereal discussion of trout. I'm watching a YouTube video of Jefferson River brown trout, Ellen Zentner capturing a beast in a net that's ginormous. Ellen, productivity is nowhere. Your Ted Weisman wrote the single best note I saw on productivity last week. You got to explain to me how any central banker at any point under any circumstances can move from Mr. Fisher's ultra accommodative with a productivity statistic like we have now. That's in none of my history books.
Well, they can't. And so here's the thing. Policymakers, and I don't fault them because private forecasters as well have been very slow to recognize that these structural issues that determine potential growth in the economy remain a problem. And Janet Yellen earlier this year said that the real equilibrium rate is about flat and will rise over time as persistent headwinds fade. Her persistent headwinds was productivity, and that they all expected productivity to rise.
Exactly.
And the real equilibrium rate would rise alongside that. But it has not risen. And I agree with you. It's one of the fantastic notes that Ted Weisman on our team has written.
Yeah, but within this complexity, we have adults, and we all agree they're brilliant. Chair Yellen is fabulous. The fact is, Ted Weisman's note, if it's handed to her, can she even raise once, one and done?
Well, you know, Janet Yellen has been asked directly before, you know, if we back out, if we reverse engineer from the Fed's own summary of economic projections what the implied productivity rate is, it's something like 1.7%. And that's just extremely unrealistic. And when pressed on it, she has said, yes, our estimates of productivity could be too high. And they all admit that. Right. But putting those stark numbers on paper has been very difficult for them to do. And I think with Jackson Hole and with the growing rhetoric coming out of the Fed, we're going to see in that September FOMC meeting that summary of economic projections table show a much more sobering take on the longer run equilibrium rate and just how slow the path will be to get there, and that the potential growth in the economy comes down. It's just a very slow-moving beast. That's how the Fed operates. And it's a new reality that they're embracing and that I think we're on the cusp of.
We gotta go.
Them
Ellen Zentner, Morgan Stanley. I don't know, 115 years after Scotland became part of the United Kingdom, a small shop 100-some miles north of Edinburgh started making scotch. And the unique feature of their scotch and the chemistry of each distillery is Macallan, which is like at the end of the James Bond movie, I know all that, is small stills, which is absolutely unique in the industry. It's so rare. It's on the back of like a pound note or something. I don't know the details. The guy that moves this in the United States is Paul Ross of Edrington Americas. Paul, I want to give you a sales pitch here before we talk about Brexit. What is it about the copper chemistry of a given scotch that makes it unique?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different... Oh, first of all, thank you for having me. There's a number of different factors, really, that come together to create that alchemy you talked about. You know, the size of the stills are very important for giving a rich, you know, concentrated new make spirit, which Macallan is unique for. But much of it actually is in the type of wood that you select. And Macallan uses 100% sherry oak casks for most of our range. They're about 10 times the price of a bourbon barrel to produce. Mm-hmm. We produce about 92% of the world's sherry oak casks. And that allows us to go, you know, create a single malt with natural color. And 70% of the flavor comes from the wood. Maybe about 30% of the flavor comes from the stills and the concentrated liquid in the water you have. So it's very complex. There is a bit of alchemy. There is some science, but ultimately there's a lot of art as well.
A few years ago, you sold a dram for $460,000. Pounds sterling matters to you, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you mentioned Brexit there, with the devaluation of the pound at the moment, we'll see some benefit in North America in terms of our sales revenue over the course of the next couple of years. But what I would highlight is, and you highlighted it yourself, we've been in business for over 200 years. There's a lot of cycles, economic cycles. We've survived recessions, prohibition, world wars. And really, you need to look at the long term. You know, we're investing about $200 million in the Macallan estate at the moment. I won't even see the benefit of that in my lifetime. I'm only 45. This is a generational investment. So therefore, short-term blips, bumps in the road don't really impact the long-term trend, which is a growth in the Scotch whiskey across the world, but and specifically Macallan doing exceptionally well in North America at the moment.
When you say long-term, what is long-term? Are we talking 20, 30, 40 years?
Yeah, typically, if you're investing in an expansion of a single malt distillery and something like the Macallan, where virtually all of our products aged, you know, 10 years and above, then it's decades before you get a payback on that type of investment. Interest rates are low at the moment, but they won't remain that way for the next 20 years. And cash flow is incredibly important to us. We have probably about $1 billion worth of investment in warehouses with casks maturing at the moment. So there's liquid gold in those warehouses, but it takes many, many years for it to mature and come to market. So as we expand our operations, I think it could be at least two decades before we see the benefit of that investment.
How do you financially justify that when you're going to your bank or whoever's funding it? You know, what do you tell them? I'm not going to have a return on investment until your kids are old enough to collect the money.
Well, there's three aspects to it. First of all, we have been in business for 200 years, so there's a lot of sunk cost in terms of our infrastructure. Second element is we're privately owned. We're owned by Scotland's largest charity, therefore it allows us to make long-term investment decisions. And second of all, we are actually investing in casks, wood, and liquid gold, as I put it. So therefore, you know, your investment's safe. It's just not quite ready yet. It's maturing, a bit like a long-term government bond. So you can justify it. We've had the same relationship with some of our banks now for decades. But ultimately, it's a long-term business, and it's not for one of the faint-hearted.
You acquired a number of years ago Cutty Sark, which is a brand from my childhood, and I understand you've got to rebuild a brand, etc. What does Brexit, what does the pound conversion do? Forget about something esoteric like Macallan. What do you do with a giant elephant, like, not elephant, but a giant brand like Cutty Sark when you're going up against your good competition?
Well, Cutty Sark is quite unusual in the sense it was the Scotch brought in during Prohibition by, you know, like the likes of Captain McCoy and was
Scotch. Excuse me, my grandfather. Thank you. Okay.
Yes. So it is the Scotch, not of your father, but your grandfather. And in many ways, that is going to help us because in this new generation are really looking for authenticity. They're looking for, there's a bit of nostalgia there. Old is new again. And a brand like Cutty Sark, which was built really in America, in the United States during Prohibition, there's a lot of interest in it, and social media, and in terms of, you know, younger consumers. So I think in some ways the fact that it was a brand of the past makes it, you know, us able to really look at it sensibly, invest in it to make it a brand for the future.
What is the wiggle room that you have on price? I mean, if you have the advantage of a weaker pound, and, you know, this will get you going, Paul Ross, the idea of Daryl Meyer at HSBC predicting a 110 sterling, which is clearly an outlier call, but that completely changes what brown liquors do out of the United Kingdom. The little bit of gin that's still made is well. Do you presume there will be a price war in your world?
Again, it's a very, this is a long-term business. You know, you're talking even some of our youngest products are 5, 6, 7 years old.
Yeah.
So there is going to be a bump in a positive way in terms of currency in the short term. And typically, most of our competitors are in the same situation. Mm-hmm. They're looking over the next 10, 15 years. So unless it was a sustained reduction in the pound, you know, something like 5, 6 years, I would be very hopeful that what we're looking at is the ability to and probably reinvest back in the business significant amounts of dollars. Mm-hmm. And go out there and communicate to consumers more clearly. Than, you know, that would be my chosen route, and I think that's probably what will happen in practice.
One more question, Paul Ross, if we could, with Edrington Americas talking about Brexit and the reality for Scotch whiskey. Your messaging is completely changed with digital. We see that with the NBC Olympic story, the digital streaming and all that. How are you going to message the branding of alcohol products 5 years from now?
Strangely enough, I don't think it changes much for us. That might sound strange for a business that's 200 years old, but we've always built our brands on word of mouth through personal recommendation. You know, friend to get friend, or your boss introducing you to Macallan, or your father, or your sister, or whatever, giving you a gift. So it's been very much about personal recommendation, and that's how we built our business. The stars in the glass and people drinking our products. So ultimately, social media and digital just literally just amplifies that beyond anything we would have been able to do 10, 15, 20 years ago. So in many ways, it just allows us to get back in the business of that personal recommendation. And you can't hide from people's recommendations out in social media. You know, if they like the product, they're going to tell you. But if they don't like it, they're going to tell lots of people. So for us, that means there's even more emphasis on making sure that the quality of what we put in the glass is exceptional. Because if it isn't, people are going to tell you, and you're going to find out very quickly.
Michael McKee and I look forward to our remote from Moray here. When, Mike? Is that the third week of October?
I think we should.
I think we should. Paul Ross, thank you so much. Edrington Americas.
You know,
we're trying to do some of the reality here, folks, of what actually happens with Brexit. I get it's macroeconomics, and we got to do all that we do, Mike, but what does it really mean?
Yeah.
I've said on air, it's not been a secret, I'm gung-ho on London. I just don't buy the gloom.
Well,
gloom for a minute.
I presume that what it means to a Scotch whiskey distiller is different than somebody who's not waiting 40 years for a return on investment.
That would be true. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Michael McKee is at McConomy. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.